of the conundrums of Friday's jobs report was what happened to education jobs. Local school districts lost 144,000 jobs last month. State, 17,000, and private education jobs fell by 19,000. So we've been trying to figure out what exactly happened there and generally what the state of education is. We're joined now by John King Jr. He's former U.S. Secretary of Education under President Obama. He is also running for governor of Maryland, my home state. Our RT Swaminathan is also with us here this morning. She covers education for us. Secretary King, thank you so much for being here. So as you, in your discussions with folks in the education community, do you know what is going on here? Why we saw such a drop in education jobs?
Yeah, well, we've got sort of three separate challenges. One is some jobs like bus drivers, we haven't paid people well enough. And it's been a challenge to get folks back to work. We're seeing this in Anne Arundel County here in Maryland, where bus drivers actually went on strike. And so we've got to pay folks more. We've got to make sure they have good benefits. That will help with those kinds of jobs. Then there's a second challenge of lots of teachers who have young children and lots of education support professionals who have young children. And we've had major challenges in the childcare sector. We ought to make childcare affordable and accessible for all. That's something I'm working on as a gubernatorial candidate, committed to universal access to quality early childhood, birth through five. That would help get some folks back. And then we have some longstanding shortages for teachers, particularly in our high needs rural communities, areas like math and science, and those have been exacerbated given the stress and challenges of the last year and a half for teachers. So we've got to invest more as a country in the recruitment and retention of our teachers.
Secretary, can you speak to whether the incentives and compensations that school districts have been offering go far enough? I mean, what can they do to attract not just the more committed workforce, but also a more diverse workforce?
Yeah, it's essential that we diversify the teaching profession. You know, a majority of kids in our nation's public schools are kids of color, but only 18% of our teachers are teachers of color. It's a huge challenge. So we've got to do more on the incentive side. That's better compensation for sure, but also loan forgiveness so that folks who want to enter the teaching profession know they're not going to be saddled with debt, that they're going to struggle to pay for years and years to come. States can do more on this front, and the federal government can as well. Hopefully we'll see the federal government make a big investment in access to higher education in this new package that's been proposed by President Biden if it gets through Congress.
Secretary, the Department of Education, you spoke a little bit about loan forgiveness, announced a few tweaks to the public service loan forgiveness program. I have heard from so many teachers over the 2 years that I've been reporting this. Do you think that goes far enough, though? Because it's just tweaks. It's not a major overhaul just yet.
Yeah, we probably need help from Congress, really, to make that program as strong as possible. There were definitely some bureaucratic hurdles that were created in the design of the program that made it hard for people to access. We need Congress to step in and address some of those bureaucratic hurdles, but the department has taken some important steps. Frankly, for Betsy DeVos and the Trump administration, public service loan forgiveness was not a priority, was not something they were interested in supporting. And that led to lots of folks getting rejected who should really have gotten their debt forgiven. So the Biden administration is trying to right the ship there. Congress can help as well.
A sort of more short-term, hopefully, issue that could be keeping some teachers out of work or in some cases putting them out of work are vaccine mandates. And yes, the unions have broadly agreed to the parameters here. But as we've seen in the healthcare profession, there are people who, as the mandates go into effect, are forced out of jobs. What's your view on how we should be thinking about those for teachers, even as we try to keep kids safe, obviously? How do you balance that? Is there a way to balance it?
Yeah, we absolutely need the vaccine mandates for teachers. I think over time, what we're seeing is that the mandates are working. That some of the folks who said initially they were unwilling to get vaccinated when confronted with a workplace mandate have actually chosen to get vaccinated. I think those numbers of folks who are refusing are going to continue to shrink over time. Now, we still need to address that if there are folks who leave as a result of vaccine mandates, we're going to need to have new folks in place. And that means we've got to invest more in our pipeline of new teachers. We've got to make sure that our colleges and universities are producing the teachers we need. And we've got to make sure we're compensating people well enough so that they choose teaching over other professions.
Secretary, it's almost 2 years since COVID began. In your view, what do you think is still the biggest underlooked challenge when it comes to the education sector right now?
Yeah, I worry a lot about the academic impact of disruptions to school. We know that there are kids who miss vital skills, a lot of unfinished learning to address. But I actually worry even more about the socio-emotional impact of this period. It's really hard for kids to be without school. I was a kid whose life was saved by school. Both my parents passed away when I was little. My mom when I was 8, my dad when I was 12. If not for the relationships at school, I wouldn't be alive today. And so I worry a lot about kids who've been isolated from peers, from teachers. We had kids who missed much of last school year, if not all of last school year, as well as a good portion of the year before. So we've got to invest in counselors, mental health services, supports for kids and their families. We have a lot of kids who lost parents, lost family members to COVID. We've got to address the impact of that trauma in their lives. Kids whose families have suffered really economically during this period. They've lost homes, lost income. That creates difficulty in kids' lives that has to be addressed. So we've got a lot of work to do over the next few years to recover. One thing that would get at both the academic and socio-emotional needs would be to mobilize a tutoring corps. Young, recent college graduates, retired teachers to work individually or in small groups, 2 or 3 students, to help students catch up academically, but also to build those mentoring relationships that can be such a positive force in kids' lives.
And just a question on student loans. The department rolled out a new Office of Enforcement last week, and it seems like they're really ramping up oversight, the Biden administration, that is. And that builds on something that you kind of worked on during your years. Can you just speak a little bit to how oversight has shifted back and forth in terms of administrations and where we are at now?
Yes. So when I was secretary, we were trying to ramp up the department's efforts to have rigorous oversight of particularly for-profit colleges. We have these predatory for-profit colleges that are essentially a scam. They promise students things, they don't deliver. Many students leave without a degree or with a degree that is meaningless. I think about a school like ITT, which our enforcement efforts helped to shut down. We were working very hard to make sure that we were protecting consumers. Betsy DeVos and the Trump administration came in, they dismantled the enforcement unit. They undermined all the regulations we had put in place to try to protect students. Now the Biden administration is coming in and trying to resuscitate that effort to have rigorous oversight. We have to make sure that when students enroll in a college, that that college is prepared and equipped to do a good job serving them and will help them get to a degree that is meaningful, allows them to compete in the economy. And these predatory for-profit colleges really need to be held to account. And I hope that's what this new enforcement unit will do.
Secretary, thank you so much. Secretary John King Jr., former Education Secretary of the United States, candidate for governor of Maryland, and our Artsy Swaminathan, thank you both for being here.
Investors are still trying to figure out if the weak September jobs report is a sign of things to come. It could be, in large part because more women are leaving the workforce during the pandemic. Joining us now is Betsy Stevenson, professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan's Ford School. Betsy, good to see you this morning. Is there a solution? How do we get more women back into the workforce?
Well, first, I want to start by saying that women have been coming back. So the idea that all these women were going to have left the labor force and not come back, just turns out not to have quite happened. So we've had roughly three quarters of men and three quarters of women have returned to the labor force. What concerned me is we've seen a real slowdown in the last two jobs reports of women returning. In fact, if you looked at the non-farm payrolls in terms of the number of jobs out there, women actually lost jobs this month. They didn't gain them. If you look over the last 2 months, the vast majority of the jobs have been going to men. So we do see some kind of slowdown. You see that in the household survey as well. Which is, you know, that the employment gains were greater for men than for women. So then you ask, what do we do about this? I think one of the things that we're seeing is a lot of people were either homesick or home caring for somebody. So we got to get COVID down. I actually am quite optimistic about October because the case rate's way down compared to, you know, that September reference week. We were having 200,000 cases a week. So we got to keep people healthy. We got to get COVID under control, and we got to get kids back in school, and we got to get daycares and other caregiving workers hired.
And on that last front, you recently signed a letter along with a number of other economists encouraging more support for home healthcare industries and spending. Because we've talked a lot on this show, and I know a lot of folks have talked about childcare, but that's only part of the picture. It's also elder care or ailing relatives, et cetera, that support is also necessary to get people back to the workforce. How does all this happen? Is it public policy? Is that just the thing that needs to happen to support these various care industries?
I think that's absolutely what needs to happen. I mean, on the home-based healthcare, there's two things going on. One, people want to be able to stay in their own homes and get care. And it's a lot cheaper to get care in your own home than to go into a nursing home. But if we have a system, a health insurance system that pushes people into nursing-based care, you know, that is not what people want, and it's expensive. So sometimes people can't get help with that home-based care, so they end up with a family member providing it. You know, what we see in the data is 2 out of 3 caregivers for adults are women, and about half of those caregivers are of prime working age and would likely be working if they weren't doing that care. So we know that that keeps women out of the labor force. And the problem is when that caregiving comes to an end, it's often too late for those women to get back into the labor force. So giving them that little bit of help with caregiving at home, being able to bring someone in to help with the responsibilities they have for adults, either elder people or adults with disability that need help, is gonna, I think, put people in a better place in terms of the care they want, relieving their family members to be able to work in the labor force, and helping to provide higher wages for those caregiving jobs.
I think a lot of folks, Betsy, are still trying to figure out why we're not getting more of an acceleration in job growth. Really, this was the second straight disappointing month for jobs. Do you see other factors holding back the job market?
I think if you look at this report, it's very clear that it's Delta that was holding it back. We saw the highest number of people working part-time because they were too sick to work full-time since April. We saw 1.53 million people out of work during the reference week because they were too sick to work. We saw a surge in the number of people who weren't able to work because there was a closure in their industry due to COVID. So, you know, the answer keeps being the same thing over and over again. You got to get the virus under control in order to get employment up there. I mean, just think about 1.53 million people who were at home sick. So, you know, COVID is not just about we don't go out there and shop. Some of us aren't healthy enough to work. So there's a lot of that going on. And there still is genuine concern from people who don't want to get out into the labor force until they think they can do so safely. And then the last thing, you've got to understand there's big changes underway in terms of demand, in terms of supply constraints, and in terms of the types of jobs people want to have. That kind of reallocation, it takes some time, and it's not going to happen overnight.
I want to follow up on that in a second. But first, I want to ask you about vaccine mandates, Betsy, because on the flip side of people staying home because they're ill, there's also a segment, at least, of people who have to leave their jobs because they won't get vaccinated, right? If you're talking about healthcare, if you're talking about education, what happens to those people?
They'll find other jobs or they'll end up getting vaccinated. I mean, the thing is, the vaccine mandates has increased employment. And, you know, it's unfortunate that there are some people who've, you know, decided that they don't want to get a vaccine. They don't have a health reason not to get the vaccine. They obviously need to find an industry or a place for them to work where they're not going to be a health risk to other people. But what we've seen is there are many, it's making it easier for companies to hire other people who don't want to be around unvaccinated people. It makes it easier for them to serve their customers. But also, as importantly, it reduces the chances that they have an outbreak where a bunch of people are homesick. I mean, what we've seen in the past with flu outbreaks is that these can be really burdensome for employers where they have a lot of people at home sick and unable to produce. So, you know, there's a health reason within the job that we need these vaccine mandates, as well as a public health reason.
Right. So to come back to the point you were making about people reassessing what kind of jobs they want, because I think probably the research you're best known for is the link between wealth inequality and happiness. And I think that that goes to the crux of the question about people reassessing. It's a question of happiness. It's a question of how much money do I want to make and what kind of quality of life do I want to have? So as we look at this process, as you say, that will take time, what should we be thinking about? What should we be watching? And what happens to those lower paid jobs that are also sort of undesirable jobs?
So one of the things that we see in the data is that people really value having control. That's probably not a big shock to anybody. People want to have control over when they work or how they work. They want to have some agency in their life about what they're doing. And so I think savvy employers who want to get people back figure out how to give them control. That might be control about what their schedule looks like. That might be control about being able to work from home some of the time. But I think the savvy employers we're learning that actually pre-COVID, and it learned it at an exponential rate during COVID. So I think that is a big part of it. I also think that, you know, people are, as you said, they're just trying to take a look at what is it that I want to be doing for work and can I do something better? Keep in mind that we're giving people a lot of opportunity when we tell them that there's a record number of jobs out there. With a record number of jobs, the smart, responsible thing for people to do is take their time finding the best job for them. We'll end up in a better place in the economy if people are able to find a good job, a job they don't want to quit next month. But that kind of reallocation, that kind of reassessment just takes a little bit of time for people to find a match where they're going to be really productive and they're going to be able to justify earning a higher wage.
Right. Well, it makes sense that would take a while. Finally, if you would allow me to make a little bit of a left turn, I want to ask you about the Nobel Prize for Economics, which was announced today, which is being awarded to three different economists in their work in so-called natural experiments. In other words, economics at work in the actual real world. For people who are not economists, why is this important and what has this research done for the profession?
Well, I think what this research has done is really shown us about the importance of doing experimental experiments and actually learning from the real world and taking those learnings from the real world to inform our economic models and economic theory, and then testing those economic models and economic theory again in the real world with data, so that there's kind of this back and forth between what we're learning from looking at the real world and running what we call a quasi-experiment. That means that, you know, unlike a medical experiment where I'm going to assign somebody to a treatment and control, I'm going to have to look around the world and see what kind of looks like a treatment, what kind of looks like a control. And often policy changes will do that. You know, I think it's great that you asked me this question at the end of our conversation, because one of the Nobel laureates, David Card, is very well known for having taken a look in the world to say what really happens when we raise the minimum wage. And what he showed was that it doesn't quite work the way economists would have thought. You know, economic models said, well, employers can hire all the workers they want at a single going wage. And if you push the wage up, then they'll let a bunch of workers go. And they found that the labor market doesn't work quite as fluidly as our standard economic models suggest. And the result of that lack of it working so fluidly in their study was to show that an increase in the minimum wage in one state did not cause employment to go down in that state compared to what was happening in the neighboring state, which didn't have a change in the minimum wage. And what they did was took that result to then think about, well, what does that mean about how we should be thinking about labor markets? And that gets us to the conversation we were having today, which is that, you know, labor markets are a little bit kludgier than our standard economic models think because of the fact that there's a lot of problems with information or finding out where you fit. You know, we don't have sort of a one size fits all labor market where people just can, you know, join a given firm as, you know, there's as many people as possible as the firm would want to hire them. that particular wage. So being able to gather real world data, take that real world data to the models and understand economics a little bit better, that's what their research was all about today. And then coming up with results that we can use to actually make our lives better off.
Betsy Stevenson, professor of public policy and economics at the University of Michigan's Ford School. Appreciate the insights.
That was Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen speaking on ABC's This Week on Sunday, saying she is confident the provisions to establish a global minimum corporate tax can be included in the reconciliation bill. Her comments came after lower tax countries, including Ireland, agreed to a minimum 15% tax on the profits of the world's largest companies. Let's bring in EY Global Vice Chair of Tax, Kate Barton, who's been following this for us. And Kate, let's talk about the next steps here, because it did feel like this was a significant step here made when you had those lower tax countries like an Ireland, like a Hungary say, yes, in fact, 15% floor works for us. How much do you think buy-in that you think that we're going to get here in the U.S. from lawmakers?
Well, I think we're going to go through a process. I mean, it was a big day on Friday to get the latest inclusive framework from the OECD and to have Ireland the day before actually sign up. It's pretty monumental to have 136 countries out of the 140 say yes, that they're aligned, that they want a minimum tax of 15%. The U.S., getting there is going to be the legislative process that we're all watching like crazy right now. I mean, every country, all 136 that have signed up, will have to go through their local efforts to adopt this in their local laws. So I don't underestimate the complexity. We certainly are seeing how hard it is to make laws in the U.S. With the Congress and such a narrow margin.
What does this mean for the companies who are going to be subject to this 15% minimum tax? As you pointed out, there's still a lot of hurdles that need to be met in order for this to become official. But we've heard a lot about especially big tech companies who could take a big hit.
Yeah, so it's really individual to every corporation, depending on their structure. They need to model this out, and we need more details to understand. Because remember, this is Pillar 2, which is one aspect of the OECD framework. The other aspect is Pillar 1, which really we didn't get a lot of details on, and that's still to come. But that is to allocate profits to distribution arms or subsidiaries of the multinational companies. And so that is where also in agreement for those new taxing rights, countries will forego the right to charge for digital services taxes, which is a big issue for a lot of multinationals in the technology, pharmaceuticals, med device, those types of companies, big manufacturers. So it's an important piece of the framework that we still don't have much information on. So both aspects are important, but the 15%, I mean, really, this is saying moving away from competing completely on just the headline tax rate. It's still, there's going to be differences by country, but a more narrower range, 15 to let's say the high could be 30, 31%. And so just, you know, trying to narrow the range on competing on headline tax rates.
What is enforcement likely to look like on this? And who shoulders the burden for that?
So I think that right now in this revenue-starved world, most governments are stacking up and getting their tax administrations ready to make sure that they get their fair share of taxes. So multinationals are concerned. There are aspects in the inclusive framework that are talking about multilateral provisions to try to get controversies decided in a more amicable and quicker way. Most multinationals just really want certainty for their financial statements. So getting this done quicker is a big deal. In terms of getting the actual framework done, I mean, I think one of the big developments is now the entire EU, all 27 member states have signed up. So the EU is planning on having a law come out soon where they will just direct that all countries in the EU, you know, get to the 15%. And it was a big deal for Ireland. You know, they wanted to make sure that they could still use the 12.5% rate on smaller size companies, companies with a revenue line of less than 750 million. So they kept that in as part of their negotiation strategy.
And finally, Kate, I wonder if we can look at this from both sides. For those corporations that are going to be subject to this 15% minimum tax, when you look at where the impact is, which sector do you think is most likely to be affected? And on the flip side, you know, this certainly means additional revenue, I would imagine, for a lot of these countries. Where are we seeing the upside on that front? I mean, which countries are likely to benefit the most?
It's, you know, there's been a lot of modeling on that to see which countries will benefit. You know, clearly tax revenues will go up, for example, in Ireland, because they'll be charging a higher rate of tax from the 12.5%. They wanted to make sure that they did that thoughtfully, because in some cases, some countries have said we'll have a lower corporate rate so that we can tax the wage earner more. And so that incents companies to come and provide more jobs for their wage earners, their population in the country. So everybody's had different philosophies on this. But, you know, clearly, you know, countries like the U.S. that have a worldwide taxation system, they give foreign tax credits for what you pay overseas. But the complexity is, how's that credit mechanism going to work? That's all under the reforms right now under the Biden administration. So a lot of moving parts here, so it's tough to predict exactly who's going to be winners and losers at this juncture. We need some of this to settle so we can get those answers out there.
Kate Barden, EY Global Vice Chair of Tax. It's good to get your insight. Appreciate the time. Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. Friday's jobs report highlighted ongoing challenges within the country's bars and restaurants. Some good news and bad news here. The jobs themselves, 29,000 new jobs were added in the sector, but the unemployment rate still remains well above pre-pandemic levels at 7.5%. Let's bring in Erica Palmer. She's Independent Restaurant Coalition's Executive Director. And Erica, it's good to talk to you today. Give me a sense of where things stand right now. Is it, I know restaurants have been upping their wages, trying to add additional incentives to get workers through the door. What do you see as the biggest challenge in filling some of these positions right now?
Well, thanks so much for having us on this morning. The biggest challenge is not filling the positions for lack of desire. It's because we have more than 200,000 restaurants that applied for relief through the Restaurant Revitalization Fund. And unfortunately, the fund ran out of money before they could be awarded those grants. And they simply don't have the financial resource to come back and bring back all of their employees as they would like to. I spoke to a restaurant owner this weekend who pre-pandemic had more than 25 employees in one restaurant. They're down to 4. They simply don't have the resource or the consistent business to bring back the rest of their staff.
I know you've been calling on Congress to refill that restaurant revitalization fund. How much specifically is needed, and what happens to some of those struggling restaurants if that fund is not added or expanded?
So 85% of restaurants who applied for funding did not receive it. The fund was funded with only $28.6 billion, and we had originally requested $120 billion. We know that there are nearly 200,000 restaurants who have applications in the portal right now, and if we just service those restaurants, we need at least $60 billion.
How much cushion do some of these restaurants you've been speaking with have right now? I mean, we're now 18 months into this pandemic. It feels like a lot of restaurants around the country have had to do a stop and go approach, opening up a little and then just pulling back. In the case of here in New York City, they've had to invest in outdoor dining, and that's additional costs. What are you hearing from your members?
Well, restaurants don't start with much of a cushion, so we should start there. They operate on very thin margins, and almost 90 cents of every dollar that they take in goes right back out into the community. And they've been struggling to survive. As you said, it's been up and down this entire pandemic, having to close, reopen, change business models, install outdoor seating. And the Delta variant has really threatened to push more and more restaurants into permanent closure. Since the beginning of the pandemic, more than 90,000 restaurants and bars have closed. And we have seen the return of dining restrictions across the country. Restaurant reservations have plummeted. For instance, in Brooklyn, they've dropped by 34%. In Cleveland, 48%. And they're just fewer people that are comfortable going out to dine. In fact, a recent study said that 60% of adults have changed their dining habits because of the Delta variant. And these businesses, you know, operated on thin margins before, but now after having to navigate the pandemic for nearly 19 months, they have a pile of debt that is continuing to build. 51% of restaurants surveyed couldn't pay their September rent.
How much flexibility are they finding in their leases?
Well, that depends on where you are and how kind your landlord is. But there's not a lot of flexibility. As you might imagine, you know, landlords have bills to pay as well. So even rents that had deferred rent for the beginning of the pandemic, those bills came due in June. I hear every day from restaurant owners that are struggling to find a way to navigate both the debt associated with paying off their rent, paying utilities, and other debts that they've incurred. It's really quite traumatic. It's dire at this point. If we don't see Congress act quickly, we're going to lose more. And when we lose these restaurants, we lose one of the largest employers in the country. Now, restaurants are America's favorite first job. We're also a leading employer of women. We've got 222 members of the House and 41 members of the Senate that have co-sponsored the bills to replenish. We just really need to get this done now.
And Erica, finally, I know you said that the hiring issues aren't at the top of the concerns for restaurants, but we have heard a lot of restaurants flag that. I know I spoke to one restaurant owner who said they had to put their plans on hold for an additional opening because they just couldn't fill the positions that were necessary. What is the number one issue right now? Do you think it comes down to wages? Is it about additional benefits? Is it about employees who used to work in this industry saying, look, you know, there are so many other opportunities out there that pay better?
I think it has more to do with stability. It's very challenging to go back to work in a restaurant right now. You don't know if that restaurant's going to have to close because of a government health mandate or any other issues in the next few weeks. So it's not a comfortable place to go back to work for many folks that need the stability of a consistent income. And that's terribly unfortunate. That's not the way it was pre-pandemic. But when we are constantly seeing fluctuations between occupancy and mandates, it's just really challenging. If restaurants receive the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, they can certainly pay more competitive wages. We've seen tens of thousands of the businesses that did receive the Restaurant Revitalization Fund pay down their 18 months of debt, offer competitive salaries for their employees, and adjust to new public health mandates with ease.
Certainly a good reminder about the challenges that are still ahead. Erica Palmer, it's good to talk to you today, Independent Restaurant Associate or Coalition's Executive Director. Female workers led the decline in the labor force participation rate in the most recent jobs report. The percentage of female workers looking for work or those who are employed dropped to the lowest level we've seen since February. Let's bring in Kevin Delaney, Charter co-founder and CEO. And Kevin, it feels like, you know, we're a broken record here. We've been talking about this for months now. There are 2 million fewer women who are in the workforce compared to pre-pandemic levels. We heard the president on Friday sort of, you know, talk about the need for childcare, obviously pushing his legislation. Is that really what it comes down to in terms of the main struggles here? That, in other words, until something is done on that front, we're not necessarily going to see women return in a big way into the workforce.
Yeah, I think there are a bunch of issues here, and I think childcare is one of the big ones. You know, we've seen several million women drop out of the labor force over the past year with the pandemic. And the idea was that as things started to come back, as schools resumed, as childcare kicked in, that we were going to see women coming back into the labor force. And so the numbers that we got late last week about the workforce participation by women dropping even further were actually pretty disappointing and significant in actually representing a new leg of decline in the workforce participation by women. So in terms of what is needed to be done to address this, there are a bunch of things. The childcare definitely would make a difference. Childcare is a lot more expensive, obviously, in the U.S. than it is in a lot of for places around the world because of a lack of government subsidies of the sort that Biden administration has been talking about. There's also just a kind of general inequity in workplaces around professional women. It's kind of more broadly, women bear the caregiving responsibilities much more than men, and there are a bunch of ways that organizations could try and address that.
And Kevin, if we talk about specific sectors, which ones have seen the biggest exits, specifically on female workers?
Yeah, so there are two sectors that come into play in the jobs report from Friday. One of them is education. And so among the reasons the job report was so disappointing is that the education sector had fewer hires than the seasonally adjusted estimates would have predicted. So that's one area. Another area where there's a lot of female employment that actually hasn't come back as much as it could have is in hospitality. And so that's things like hotels and restaurants and bars, places like that. That's actually been slow to come back with the Delta upsurge. And also, we're getting a sense that there's a reluctance among a lot of workers, particularly those with kids, to actually expose themselves in some of those frontline jobs. So those are two of the sectors. And obviously the prospects for a vaccination for younger kids might actually be pretty significant in terms of women feeling more available to actually go back to their jobs or return to the workplace.
Yeah, no question. A lot of parents, women as well as men, have been really concerned about with young kids not having, obviously, the vaccinations available yet, too. So hopefully that comes soon, especially as that leads to a return to the workforce. Kevin Delaney, Charter co-founder and CEO, it's good to talk to you today.
One quarter of critical infrastructure in the U.S. is now at risk of flooding, and that's according to a new report which highlights the flood risk to utilities, airports, shipping ports, and emergency services such as police, fire, hospital, running the gamut. Jeremy Porter of First Street Foundation is joining us now to break it all down, along with Yahoo Finance's Karina Mitchell once again. Jeremy, this is fascinating. We've seen so many pockets of the U.S. under pressure from various risks you have on the West Coast, fire risk, and on the East Coast, especially the Southeast, flooding risk. What are their findings in this report?
Yeah, well, this report is the third report in a series of reports that we produced. The first, where we were interested in property risk specifically. The second, we were primarily interested in economic damages as a sort of a tangible way to understand that risk. And then this third report is really focused on community risk, but giving a more holistic understanding of what risk looks like for any given property, but also for the larger communities. And as you mentioned, we focused on residential properties to this point. We know that the risk for residential properties is larger than what we would have understood just from our public facing federal FEMA maps. But this was actually surprising to us in the sense that we found that critical infrastructure and roads, for instance, were at a higher risk than even residential properties.
And Mr. Porter, you are report was really fascinating. It was eye-opening. I wonder if you could share with us, just for people that haven't read it, where are the biggest geographical risks right now? And how quickly is that map growing? And the reason why I ask that is here in New York, we just dealt with catastrophic flooding, right, from Hurricane Ida. And so, our transit system sort of overwhelmed. There were 100 deaths. That's something that New Yorkers don't typically expect to see, but they do now.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's two points here. One, the first is that risk is high where you'd expect it to be high in a lot of places. So the Florida Gulf Coast, Louisiana, and places where we typically associate high risk occurrence of flooding and that have historically been impacted by hurricanes and tropical storms. But another thing that really was interesting to us, which is something we found consistently in our flood reports, is the fact that inland around Appalachia and all the way up in New England, we're seeing a lot of risk that was previously unknown because of the ways in which our current understanding of flood risk are informed. We understand in those locations, risk is primarily driven by heavy precipitation. And as the climate changes moving into the future, the warming atmosphere, the warming sea surface temperatures are actually fueling tropical cyclones so that they're stronger And because they're stronger, they're moving slower as they move further north. But at the same time, they're able to keep their strength further latitudinally. So they're reaching New York, they're reaching Southern New England, they're reaching Virginia at a rate that they haven't in the past. And when we look at our analysis, we're seeing the normal spots that have high flood risk, but looking into the future, we're starting to see a lot of areas that we traditionally would not have associated with having high flood risk become more and more at risk of flooding.
And I have to echo Karina's surprise there living in the city. I'm actually from Miami, so I've seen catastrophic flooding firsthand many times over. But you have a handle on the data here on the problem, and that's the first step. I'm wondering then, what is the solution and how long is this going to take?
Yeah, our mission at the First Street Foundation is really to quantify and communicate flood risk. There's a lot of this data that exists out in the world. The problem is it's not easily accessible. So our goal is to take this data, make it easily accessible, and then to give people, homeowners, community leaders, the information that they need to make the best decisions. Clearly, there's a lot more risk than what we originally had thought. And there are a lot of smart decisions that can be made based on having the proper data. Up until this point, a lot of individual property owners and a lot of small communities haven't had access to high quality flood risk information. So while we are in a sort of a changing environment, we're seeing more flood risk. We're only going to see that grow into the future. It's more and more important now than ever to make sure we have the proper data to make decisions off of.
And sir, tell me, what does a price tag look like to fix this problem? Because it is just so immense, right? And does President Biden's infrastructure bill, whether it's $3 billion, whether it's $2 trillion, does that even start to make a dent in the problem? What is the immediate challenge that needs to be addressed? Only a couple of seconds left.
Yeah, that's the trillion-dollar question, right? But we've created the data. We understand the economic damage implications for property owners. We haven't gone as far as quantifying the impact on infrastructure economically. So Biden's bill could certainly help in a lot of these places. But again, our stance is that we create the best data available and allow the experts to make decisions with that data.
Price tag unknown. Jeremy, thank you for coming here. As always, Jeremy Porter, First Street Foundation.
The company is called Science 37. Their CEO, David Coman, joins us now because the way the United States and different pharmaceutical companies, developers test their medications, Science 37 is changing that to give us better results. And David, we appreciate your being here. If I got that wrong, correct me, because when it was first suggested that we bring you into the stream, I was asking the people who were speaking to us, well, what does Science 37 offer that doesn't already exist? And they explained it very well, is that we've tested medicines, but left whole groups of people out of the testing, and you've corrected that.
Yes. Well, thanks. First of all, thanks for having me on the show. Appreciate it. Science 37 is enabling universal access to patients anywhere, regardless of geography. And as a result, we are disrupting what ultimately is a $195 billion market. And the way we do this is through our operating system. Our operating system has two components, the first of which are what we call our specialized networks. That includes telemedicine investigators. Those are the doctors that are managing the patients, mobile nurses who go into patients' homes to be able to triangulate care with that investigator and patient, and remote coordinators who choreograph the entire study. This all takes place in the second component, which is our technology platform, which includes the workflow in order to be able to orchestrate everything, the evidence that's required to be gathered in the trial, all to harmonize that data for submission to the FDA. Now, if I compare that to the way clinical research has traditionally been done, traditional research is done through a series of clinics or what we call sites that are mapped throughout the world. Each of those sites have their own people, processes, and technologies in order to be able to pull the data in. But to date, only about 5% of providers want to participate in clinical research. So that makes the number of clinicians, you know, my very vast minority of the total population. And of course, they're the ones that are recruiting patients from their local geography, which means only about 8% of patients ever get approached about joining a clinical research study. This makes a big issue if you're thinking about how do you go find the right number of people in order to participate in the clinical study. And Science 37, right, by after the entire population, is giving us the ability to attract patients faster, up to 15 times faster. We're retaining patients up to 28% longer, and we're getting three times the diversity in the clinical research than otherwise is being done in the traditional model.
That was when I was talking with your staff before the interview, that really jumped out at me is take it for granted that these tests that are done, these studies that are done, are broad-based and inclusive, when in fact, sometimes large cultural groups, racial groups are left out of the studies, which would seem to me might not give you the best result. Is that accurate?
Well, it's important to note that getting the right patient populations isn't just a social issue. It's actually a scientific issue, because ultimately these medicines need to be tested in the marketplace with the right people who are a representative population that are using them. And so to be able to find the right patients and introduce those patients into clinical research is incredibly important. And if you are relying just on a geographically based hospital, then you're excluding a percentage of the total patient population. But it's not just not just diversity groups. It's actually patients of all sorts. I think a great story for you. The first study that I ever was able to go into, this is a couple of decades now ago, but mind you, this model has been the same way for the last 60 to 90 years. It was in coastal Carolina, and there was a hospital system there where I met, you know, Fred and Eleanor, who were a couple of patients that traveled 2.5 hours in order to get to the site. They waited in the waiting room for 45 minutes. And then after waiting, they finally got to see the doctor. When they saw the doctor, they were told that they can come back every month now for the next 2 years to do this visit. So 2.5 hours plus 45 minutes in the waiting room. And by the way, Fred had advanced Parkinson's disease. And so think about, you know, a patient on any therapeutic area, much less, you know, Parkinson's, cancer, MS, ALS, you name it. And then geography starts to become a big issue. And Science 37 has been able to resolve that and not only get participation from virtually anyone, anywhere, but also do it on one platform that aggregates all that data together so that there's not manual reentry of data from one site into a system and another site into a system. It's all within the Science 37 platform, ultimately revolutionizing the way clinical research gets done.
Are you allowed to share with us who some of your clients for this kind of testing, who some of those clients might be?
I can tell you that we're working with large pharma, we're working with mid-sized pharma, biotech, some government work as well, some academic. The application for Science 37's operating system is virtually everybody. And it all goes into this whole universal access ideological view that we have of the world. And I'd invite anybody, if you are a sponsor, or if you're an investigator, a patient, a provider, to come to science37.com to learn a little bit more. And we have a lot of information there that can give you a lot of depth about what we're doing.
So what's going to come next? You're now publicly traded. I believe you're going to be ringing the bell again. Correct me if I get it wrong, coming up over at NASDAQ. What's going to be next for you? Because the people who watch our program are always looking for the kind of investment that they can make that others aren't paying attention to. And it seems to me you're not off the beaten path, but you should get a lot more attention than you're getting.
Well, thanks a lot. Really appreciate that. With this transaction, of course, we've raised a lot of funds, and we're going to be utilizing that to help expand the company geographically, commercially, technologically. And as we continue to expand, we should be accelerating our overall progress. If you just take a look at our bookings, which are our sales from the first half of 2021 relative to the full year of 2020, we're already at 150%, again, against the full year number in 2020. Our revenues already have outpaced what we came in full year 2020. We already did that in the first half of this year. And we expect us to continue to grow and expand as the, you know,